Commonwealth.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Hargett, and I represent Ms. Johnson on the appeal of her convictions out of the city of Richmond. You know, Ms. Johnson was convicted of...
Care to reserve...
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll attempt to save about 3 minutes.
All right. About 3 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. Ms. Johnson was tried and convicted of robbery and use of a firearm in the commission of a robbery. So the defense in the case was that she did have items that were from the robbery itself, and she didn't deny that she used the credit card of the victim of the robbery. So the defense in this case is simply that there was an unexplained possession of the credit cards. And so I would like to focus first on
unexplained and very recent possession, given the timing of the videotape, right?
Exactly. I mean, it was about an hour or so, I believe, was the best way it was. The timing looked like it was about an hour or so. So the jury was instructed on what a robbery is, of course, and what the elements of a robbery. And the jury was instructed on the generic burden of proof that it must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. But the jury wasn't given any indication as to how to evaluate the actual defense theory in the case. That defense theory being that, yes, they had the credit cards and they used the credit cards, but that doesn't mean they committed the robbery.
Go ahead.
Granted, it's a correct statement of law, but that doesn't mean necessarily that it's an error not to give that instruction, does it?
Of course not, but it is a vital instruction to the defense. It is the defense in the case. And it's also not further explained.
But there was more evidence than just mere possession of recently stolen items. There was the identity by the victim, the identification. Doesn't that put it in a whole different category?
Well, no, because the question is whether the jury instruction should have been given. And then the question, which that might go to harmless error or not, but the question of whether the jury instruction should have been given is whether there is evidence to support that instruction and whether it's a correct statement of law. And in this case, it's a vital piece of evidence to the defense. Now, as far as what the victim testified to, keep in mind, and I pointed this out in the brief, although he testified that he identified them in court, after all, they are facing trial, et cetera, it's pretty easy to go, yes, those are the two people that did it. But right after the robbery occurred, he, one, picked out Mr. Pettis in a photo lineup, but was not certain it was him. And number two, he could not identify Ms. Johnson in a lineup. So the identification is really the whole subject of this case.
But doesn't that, independently of that, that goes to the weight of the identification. But in reference to the jury instruction itself, the court found that a couple of different things. One, the Bazemore case that was relied on was not applicable, was factually distinct in this particular case. But circling back to, you don't have to accept that. I'm just saying that that's what the court found. Bazemore itself, how does it help you? Because what it really says is that this is a correct statement of the law, but doesn't necessarily indicate in that particular case that it was required to be given. That's not the reason for the reversal.
Exactly. The court didn't need to consider that issue because they reversed it on another ground. But, I mean, that's the only case that we have. So that's how it helps me, because it tells you that it's a correct statement of the law. And here, what's really frustrating is there's a lot of precedent from this court and from the Virginia Supreme Court that says that a defendant is entitled to have his theory of the case instructed to the jury.
But if it's covered in another instruction, they're not entitled to duplicative instructions, are they?
That's correct.
And they're not necessarily entitled to impermissibly sort of highlight or pull out something.
I don't know how much I would agree with that. I mean, the Commonwealth gets to highlight.
But you would indicate that there's case law to that point.
That you're not allowed to highlight certain testimony in a case, but this is a legal concept. This is not a factual concept. So what the instruction does is all it says is just because they possessed the credit card and used it after the robbery doesn't, standing alone, mean that they're guilty of the robbery itself.
If the jury followed the standard robbery instruction, what they had to find, and understood your theory, why is the instruction necessary? Because definitionally, if they followed the robbery instruction, we've got more than just possession.
I mean, again, the Commonwealth gets these inferences and instructions all the time. You may infer malice from this. You may infer malice from use of a deadly weapon. You may, once there's an unlawful killing, you may presume it was second-degree murder. I mean, all of these things are the Commonwealth's theory of the case. They get to have their jury instructions. Why can't we have ours? And the reason why it's very important is because the robbery instruction doesn't mention anything about possession of stolen items. He wasn't charged with, neither defendants were charged with the possession of the stolen property or the use of the stolen property, credit card theft or credit card fraud. So the only instruction that they're given is a robbery instruction, and that robbery instruction doesn't say anything about what the jury should do with the fact that they actually had the items after the robbery occurred. So, you know, the defense can argue it all day long, but a jury instruction, an instruction from the court, carries weight in here. Arguments don't carry any weight. The jury is told this is just argument.
Did you just say nobody should pay you because nothing you say carries any weight?
No, if that is, that might be true. But as far as the appeal is concerned, I think what we say here matters a little bit. But as far as a jury instruction, the instruction from the court itself as to a matter of law that the jurors are required to follow, as they swore they would follow the jury instructions, that becomes very important. And without that instruction, the jury has no idea that they're not allowed to simply say, well, they had the cards, they must have done the robbery.
But
that's the whole point.
That's not what the instruction says in terms of the robbery instruction. And so if the elements of the robbery instruction are not met, obviously there has to be a finding of not guilty, correct? And so by that analysis, wouldn't the mere presence not be enough to sustain the conviction?
Well, you're talking about whether
talking about the whether it's duplicate of.
Well, it isn't. I mean, if the argument were that any time the jury can find that there wasn't a reasonable doubt, there was a reasonable doubt as to one or more elements of the offense, then we don't need any other jury instructions. That would be true. But the whole point of providing the jury is to provide them with instructions about the whole case. And if you're not given any indication as to what that actually means, then a jury can certainly, is the reason why it's a correct statement of law, is because the jury can say, well, we're going to assume that he did it or they did it because they had the stuff afterwards. That's the concern. And the jury is not told they can't do that. And that's what this jury instruction does. It doesn't say anything like that in the elements of a robbery. So I would like to move on real briefly because there is the other issue, and I did take the second one first, and I'll take the first one now. So that issue has to do with whether or not there should have been a mistrial granted. Now, I understand the officer didn't get to finish his sentence when he said there was a robbery, there was another robbery, but the context of that questioning was such that he was being asked, how did you find Mr. Pettis and Ms. Johnson?
What do we do about the curative instruction in terms of how that might impact your argument?
Well, and it's a bell that can't be unrung, is the argument. I mean, it's highly prejudiced. So if you accept...
told us instructions. They've sworn to follow them, and they're going to follow them. I mean, that was your whole argument on a sign of error, too. Why should we presume that they didn't follow it here?
You don't have to presume it, but you can understand that it's hard to get something like that out of your mind. If you agree with the premise that the officer was testifying that they were suspects or had committed another robbery in a different case.
But
that's
didn't
not
say
what
that.
Said.
I understand that, but
right.
So that these are the two different arguments, right. And that's why. So if you accept that premise, then the damage, the harm, cannot be undone. It's a cat that's been let out of the bag. I mean, it's hard for a jury, even if you tell them, don't consider that at all, it's already there. And so that's the whole point.
All the witness got out, though, was, well, there was this prior... robbery.
Right.
Stop. Objection. And so there's not been anything said to link the prior robbery up to these particular defendants.
I think that there was. I mean, if you look at the questions that preceded, what he's talking about is, I went to go look for them. Where did you go look for them? Well, there was another robbery. So he's going to the place where the other robbery was to look for them. naturally you're going to assume that what he's talking about is they were involved in another robbery. I don't see how you can read the record any differently than that. And again, I understand that there is a cautionary instruction given. I mean, if that, but that doesn't cure every single violation. It doesn't. It can't get rid of something that's already implanted in somebody's mind.
Well, yeah, but that would mean that no curative instruction. I mean, that's the dilemma. I mean, you're asking us to say the curative instruction didn't work in this case, but if that's the argument, then the curative instruction would work in no cases.
Well, and maybe that might be true. If we're talking about...
It's clearly not the law.
If we're talking about the most damaging thing that can be said about a defendant who's facing robbery charges, what's the one thing that you could say about a defendant that's the worst thing that you could say in court?
He confessed.
He confessed, okay. How about number two? Number two, what's the prejudicial? Now, that might be factual. I'm talking about what's the most prejudicial thing that can be said, that he committed another robbery. He or she was involved in another robbery. That shows propensity. That's the whole reason why we exclude that evidence, unless there's a very good reason for it coming in. And even when it does come in, a cautionary instruction is given that you may not consider this as evidence that they committed this crime. So that's why it's so very important. It's one of those situations where no curative instruction can remove the harm that was inflicted by the officer's testimony once you understand what the questioning was and what his answer was clearly indicating is that they were involved in another robbery. And if I may, I would reserve the remainder of my time.
Very well. Thank you. Ms. Johnson?
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Victoria Johnson, and I appear on behalf of the Commonwealth.
Would you agree that a defense is entitled to an instruction on their theory of the case so long as the instruction is non-duplicative, it's an accurate statement of the law, and it's supported by more than a scintilla of the evidence?
I think that's a correct statement of the law, Your Honor. I don't think that that's our case, though. I think that in this case, the proper jury instruction was, in fact, duplicative. As I argued on brief, the general robbery instruction states that the Commonwealth must prove each of the elements of a robbery, obviously. You know, that the taking was by force, it was from the person or presence of the other, that there was violence involved or a threat of violence or a firearm. And that cuts against the notion that the jury didn't know that they couldn't convict just because she possessed the credit card.
I think counsel's position is that they're entitled to having maybe that highlighted, that it's not included in the body of what's the model jury instruction for robbery, that simply mere possession of it is not enough.
Sure, Your Honor. And the Supreme Court of Virginia has spoken to that in cases that I cited in my brief, Your Honor, and has said that a litigant actually isn't entitled to have particular evidence highlighted. That could give the impression in this case that the Commonwealth's only theory and only evidence was the possession of the stolen goods, and that's simply incorrect.
If the jury followed the robbery instruction, could they have convicted if the only evidence was possession?
No, Your Honor, because, and I think that's the keystone to this case. If the jury properly and followed instructions, and the law is that we presume that they do so, then they could not have convicted of robbery based solely on the mere possession, recent unexplained possession of stolen goods. Another reason why this jury instruction isn't really applicable, the larceny instruction about recently stolen goods, I tripped over a little bit, goes to a permissive inference, I believe, in larceny that just doesn't exist in robbery. And while there is that permissive inference in larceny, it's not enough to sustain a conviction on its own, hence the instruction. And I don't think that same permissive inference really lies in a robbery case because of what the court just pointed out, that for a robbery, by necessity, you have to prove that force and that it was from a person. Otherwise, it's just not a larceny. Not a robbery.
On the scintilla of evidence question, Was there any evidence that they had come into possession of the credit cards by means other than robbery?
No, Your Honor. And that is another point that I tried to make on brief as well, was that there really wasn't an unexplained possession here. Here we had a victim who identified both of these individuals in court as his robbers, as the people who robbed him at gunpoint. The defendant in this case, Ms. Johnson, literally frisked him looking for belongings, she searched his socks looking for things to steal from him. So I submit that there isn't really a scintilla of evidence here, or more than a scintilla of evidence here, and that the instruction would be duplicative in any event. If the court has more questions on the jury instruction issue, I'm happy to address it, but I would move on. Thank you, Your Honor. Going to the mistrial issue, the defendant argues that there was no way to unring that bell. I would argue that the bell was never actually rung. The witness was cut off before he really said anything.
But counsel, would you concede that there's an inference to be drawn by the jury that if they're on trial for robbery, and then the officer is indicating how he found them was in reference to another robbery, not directly saying I was investigating them, but I mean, is there any type of prejudicial element that essentially a curative instruction would not address?
Respectfully, no, I would not concede that, Your Honor. Here, the witness was asked, well, how did you find them? And he said, well, there was another robbery, and then there was the objection, or a previous robbery, I believe. There's nothing linking his statement to these defendants other than the how did you find them question.
As the person who has to argue and is defending the conviction, are you happy that the trial court gave the curative instruction?
I'm always happy when there's a curative instruction, Your Honor.
Doesn't that suggest that there was a reason to give one?
Reading the record, Judge, I would say that the court made a factual finding, and the court made pretty explicit factual findings, that this was not a prejudicial statement, that the jury, not knowing about the other charges, could not have had enough information to link the two. Because, as the court said, the jury doesn't know what we know, what the attorneys knew and the parties. So the jury couldn't link the two. But in an abundance of caution, the judge gave the curative instruction. Now, if this is decided on the curative instruction, I submit affirmance is, again, correct, because the jury is presumed to follow that instruction. There's no indication in the record that they did not follow that instruction. And I would draw the court's attention to the Lewis case that I cited on brief, where the Supreme Court of Virginia affirmed on a limiting instruction. There, the prosecutor had called into question the defendant's defense and had persisted in doing so even after being told not to by the court. The court gave a cautionary instruction in that case, and the Supreme Court affirmed. That was a mistrial case as well. And I would submit that case would control the outcome here. If there's other questions on the first issue, I'm happy to address them. Thank you very much. I rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Horgan.
Thank you, Your Honor. The curative instruction that was given in this case was simply that the jury should disregard the last thing the officer said. And that's understandable.
Do you want to speak to her point that she raised in terms of not having any jury information about the prior robbery, and so therefore there wouldn't be the linking between the robbery that they were on trial for?
Again, if you look at the questions when this statement occurs, it is how did you find the defendants, Mr. Pettis and Ms. Johnson in this case? And he was investigating them, so he went to look for them. Where did you go look for him? And that's when he says there was another robbery. So I think that there is a link there that they're basically telling the jury that these two individuals were either suspects in or had committed another robbery. Otherwise, his answer wouldn't make any sense. Now, he got caught off before he could finish it, so maybe the jury could wildly speculate that he was just talking about, you know, I once went out and did something and I got a phone call and that's when I went to go find them, but that doesn't make any sense. If you look at what he said, he's looking for them where there was another robbery. And that's the only inference that the jury could make there. And again, it's something that you cannot take out of their minds. If they made that connection, and I argue that they did, that I reiterate that that's pretty much the most egregious thing that can be said, about a defendant facing a robbery charge is that they committed another robbery. And so I would ask the court to grant a new trial based on that. As far as the jury instruction is concerned, man, I can't stress this enough. I mean, this is exactly what the defense in the case was. It's a correct statement of law. And there is a scintilla of evidence.
But given the robbery instruction itself, you weren't hindered in your ability to make the argument that you wanted to make, that just having it's not enough. You have to show taken from the person by force, threat, or intimidation. You got to make all of those arguments. You could make the very argument you made under the instructions that were given.
A closing argument from counsel, of course, I wasn't trial counsel, but closing argument from counsel doesn't, like I said, doesn't mean anything. The jury's instructed that it's just their thoughts, their opinions. They're trying to advocate. They're trying to persuade. The jury is not just given the law from the bench.
Well, right, but if the issue, the argument is fairly, that's the issue in front of us, is was it fairly covered in the instructions that were given? Given the robbery, the standard robbery instruction, it seems to me that the argument is available.
The standard robbery instruction has nothing to do with him. They're possessing items from the robbery.
Where's the scintilla of evidence in reference to the unexplained possession?
Well, it's unexplained possession because clearly there's evidence they possessed it. They're caught on videotape using the credit cards, et cetera, et cetera.
With an explanation given.
It's unexplained because the defense doesn't have the burden to testify as to why they had it.
I didn't say they had a burden to necessarily testify, but in terms of presenting evidence as to why they had possession of it, that doesn't have to be through the defendants. It could be through just some of their witness, something else.
But the defendant doesn't have to present any evidence of that. It's merely, and that's why the instruction
right,
is...
Right, but that doesn't mean there's evidence in the record for the point. What is the evidentiary explanation other than he took it from me, she patted down and took stuff out of my socks?
The scintilla of the evidence is they possessed it. That's all you need to grant this jury instruction. The rest of the jury instruction is the law.
Well, what makes it unexplained?
And if I may, I see I'm out of time. I'd like to answer that question. It's unexplained. That's a reference to the fact that the defendant does not need to present evidence to explain why he had the stuff in his possession. That's the whole point. They don't have to present any evidence of that. The only thing that they have to do is they have to show that there's enough evidence here, or the lack of evidence, to raise a reasonable doubt. Again, the robbery instruction doesn't touch on what the jury takes away with that information, how they view that information, and it's easy to conclude that if they had it after the robbery occurred, they must have committed the robbery. This instruction tells them they can't make that jump.
Thank you very much. We'll step down and greet counsel and thereafter take up the case of Moore.